Hello, everyone. Welcome to Yachting USA. I am your host, Rick Thomas. After almost 45 years working in the maritime industry, I've met my fair share of industry characters, leaders, and influencers. This podcast is a deep dive into the North American yachting industry as I bring their stories and experiences to you. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with my friend, Bobby Jennings, who has joined me from his boat, BG Schrader. Actually, I think he's actually on his property in Norman Cay in the Bahamas. Bobby, welcome to the Yachting USA podcast.
Rick, thanks very much. Great to join you.
Oh, what a pleasure. It looks like you're having some stunning weather there, too.
It's always better in the Bahamas.
That's what they say. And who has more fun than you?
Sure, it goes without saying.
I've always admired that. It's been fun. We were talking earlier about how we find our pleasure in the water. And during COVID in particular, I was fortunate to have my boat moored behind my house, and my boys were able to jump on the boat, and we were out diving and just being on the ocean and just the social distancing and loving life. And I thought at that time, wow, who has more fun than we do? And I think at the end of the day, that's the big attraction to yachting. And it's a nice segue into, how'd you get into this? I know you got into boating by going fast. I think you had a love for a really cool Canadian-built speedboat. Want to tell us about that a little bit?
Like most Canadians, we all have summer homes up on the lake. And one of the things that we all love to do is collect old wooden boats. And I was lucky enough to be at the marina one day, and I had walked into the marina, and there sitting was Miss Canada 3. And for me, having had some experience in wooden boats, Miss Canada 3 was probably the most beautiful boat that I'd ever seen. And I inquired about her, and the marina owner had told me that the boat had just come in today and it was for sale. And what made the boat so special is it was the first Canadian boat to break the world speed record and win in its day the prestigious Gold Cup, which was raced on the Detroit River. And it was an amazing boat, and that started my whole wooden boat collection.
Give us a perspective. What was that speed record? How fast was that boat going when it got that record?
It was 1939. You've got to remember everything was wood. It was an amazing story. They ended up dropping in a Merlin airplane engine. So all the gauges in the boat are airplane gauges.
Oh, wow.
It was pretty amazing. And then funny enough, I ended up buying the boat and we would take it around the lake. She would easily go over 100 miles an hour. And everywhere I went, all the old timers on the lake, we'd go, gosh, Bobby, it's so wonderful you've got Miss Canada 3. So it's a shame that you don't have Miss Canada 4. I go, what are you talking about? What's Miss Canada 4?
Okay.
So I a little bit of research, and it was in a museum, and I ended up phoning the museum, and this is Bobby Genovese. Oh, Mr. Genovese, we've heard of you. Congratulations on having Miss Canada 3. And I said, funny enough, I'm calling because I'd like to have Miss Canada 4. And they said, Mr. Genovese, we really don't sell our exhibits. You know what? Sorry. Long story longer, excuse me, I was able to create a deal and ended up buying Miss Canada 4. And buying her, she was the first boat in the world to crack 200 miles an hour on the water.
No.
There you go. 1950, so everything was stone wood. Anyway, so she's in my collection as well, and she's powered by a Rolls-Royce Griffin engine, the same engines that are in the Royal Air Force in World War II. And he took that in, dropped it into the boat. So you push the button and you're going 35 miles an hour. And you've got to remember, there's no reverse.
Yes.
You know, coming into the dock, you got to figure out when to stop the engine and drift in.
But, wow. You have to have some good dock help there too then.
that just a couple of the boats in my collection, but that's how it all started.
Love it. Must be a stunning collection too. So that was obviously not your last boat. You've moved up over the years into bigger and bigger boats. I'm aware of a Sunseeker that you had in your fleet at one point in time, and then a 78 Lazera.
Yeah, the Lazera really was my first forte into or foray into bigger boats. It was a brand new design that Dick Lazera and the family had come out with. It was actually 75 feet. And it was 2008. And I was this close to buying the boat. And I thought, you know what? It just didn't feel right. So I ended up walking away from the deal. But I told Dick, I apologize, but if you are in a situation where you have to sell a boat, call me and let me rethink about it. And of course, 2009, the housing crash happened.
Yeah.
People ended up defaulting on their purchases. And Dick called and said, look, I've got a boat here in the yard. The owner has backed out of the deal. I can give it to you at cost. And I said, look, let me come up and take a look. So I drove up to Tampa, Florida, which is where they were being manufactured. And
up there in Rattlesnake Point.
Got it. And Rick, it was an amazing boat. I told Dick, I love it, but we need to make some changes. And he said, what does that mean? I said, you know, a forward VIP cabin, I can't have my guests in cabin one little window above that. We need to put windows on the side of the boat. He goes, gosh, I don't know if we can do that. Yeah, and I said, look, I think you can do it. He goes, what else? I said, I've got two young kids. And the moment they get seasick, it's all over. You need to put stabilizers on this. Because you don't need stabilizers on a Chevy. Anyway, he put stabilizers in. And then it went to the aft deck. And I said, yeah, Dick, this little swim platform doesn't work. My kids live between the water and the back deck. We need to lengthen this by 3 feet. And I need to put a jet ski on it. I need to put an umbrella and a chair on it. This is truly a living area. It needs to be hydraulic so I can lift it up and down. Anyway, to Dick's credit, he made all of those changes. And there, for every boat after mine, they modified it to include all of those changes. So I feel like I had a little more.
You certainly did. In fact, it's an interesting little segue and little fun fact that I was involved with Dick when they were designing the first Lazeras after the Gulfstar thing came crashing down. And we integrated those little davits in his boats that were up on the upper flybridge deck. But then when it was time to put the swim platform lifts on, my company at the time, Nautical Structures, designed and built those. So I guess I should thank you for that impetus to bring that business to our table because, yeah, we've been doing that work with the Lazeras until they ended their business. And another little fun fact is 2 weeks from today, I'm up in St. Pete Beach sitting down at Dick Lazera's home having a conversation like this with him. Great guy in the industry, someone I've known for 36 years. It was Dad. So cool business. I answered my question. You have met them. And wow, nice to see the circle come around.
Buddy.
Isn't it though? But that Lazera, that was a small boat compared to what you've got right now, the 47-meter Fedship, BG Charade.
Well, yeah. So I truly, Rick, I still love that Lazera. I've sold it, but I'm actually in negotiations right now to buy it back. I loved that boat. But I would take the boat from Florida to the Bahamas, and I would go into a new development here in Nassau called Albany. And as I went to Merida in Albany, there was probably the next to Miss Canada 3. There was a boat called Charade, which had been owned by Paul Allen. And then Paul Allen sold it to Joe Lewis.
Yeah.
Is the one that actually had created, Albany with Tiger Woods and Ernie Els. And Rick, Charade was a classic Fedship. And it's really one of the most beautiful boats. The lines of that classic Fedship are spectacular. And I just promised myself one day I would love to own that boat. And I was lucky enough that day came around and I bought it.
Congratulations.
Look, it's been 10 years. Bought it in 2014. We've literally traveled around the world. It's been amazing for my kids. It's been amazing for me. Incredible adventures. It's been spectacular.
So I have to ask, because I am aware that you have undergone at least two refits that I'm aware of. One was done at Drekker Shipyard shortly after you acquired the boat. I think the second one was done while you had the boat in Thailand.
Right.
And I think there's a quote attributed to you that says something along the lines of, buy it done.
Well,
let's touch that a little bit, shall we? Can we?
Look, the problem with a refit is it just doesn't stop. I thought I got a good price on the boat, and I did. But sometimes relationships, the girl I'm dating is an architect and interior designer. And her nickname is Mrs. No Budget. And it was true. So she literally redid the entire boat, raising the ceiling, knocking out some walls, taking out the dining room, turning it into a bedroom. It just didn't stop. But to her, when it was all said and done, she made a super yacht. Awarded her, I think, number 5 or number 6 in the world for refits in 2016. The refit took 2 years to do. But at the end of it, the boat is spectacular.
Fantastic. Yes, I saw that boat in Monaco, and she is gorgeous. She looked great at the dock, by the way. And it looked like you're having a great time over there with her. The refit experience, you like I said, you did two of them that I'm aware of. You did some work in Thailand too. What was that like?
It was through COVID. It was the right thing to do because the boat was stuck there and it couldn't move because of COVID and most of the countries were closed. But there was an opportunity where the shipyard was open. But you can imagine trying to ship parts from North America, Europe to Thailand during COVID was an exercise in itself.
Oh, yeah.
There's obviously, you hate to say it, but a language barrier. Some things could have been done a lot better. When all is said and done, the boat needed a refreshing because at that point, the last refit had been 5 years earlier, 6 years earlier. So it worked out. It worked out the way it was. Good.
That's what you want. That's what you want. And these refit experiences for you as an owner, of course, when you talk about the unlimited budget and the time frame that happens under, so often I believe that is because you've got a moving scope and you've got trains that, you know, don't perform or they can't perform, technologies that evolve maybe that becomes attractive, all of that. But that aside, there's always that conversation about buying the yacht new or buying a vessel and turning it into your vessel through a refit program. And to do it all over again, you good path buying a classic established vessel and doing the refit, or what does that look like from the perspective of someone such as yourself?
Oh, I think I went into it a little naive. I thought I could do this and this within, as I said, you go in with a budget that you think you're going to spend. And at the end of the day, I just got a quote to get the boat repainted.
Seven figures.
$1.7 million.
Yeah. I expected to hear that.
$1.7 million. And I'm thinking, I can get 4 guys and myself and go down and probably paint that in a month or 3 weeks. And I'm thinking, I need to charge $1.7 million. To paint a boat. And things like that shed me over the as I yeah. just
yeah I it, get it and it
dollars why the boat is not that much bigger than a house. Why are we at $1.7 million? I think I was just naive in the marine industry, what needs to happen, how it happens, and the cost of things. So I think if I could do it all over again, I'd rather somebody else do all the work and then I buy the classic. That's the way to do it. There I am. new next time for sure.
Yeah. Now, this is an interesting industry, and people come into it and oftentimes struggle with the realities. Painting, for instance, is such a voodoo art because you're dealing with, I don't want to say esoteric finishes. What's acceptable to one is completely unacceptable to another, and the entity that's doing the paintwork has got to commit to making you satisfied. And I've seen some real, for no better word, shit shows happen, and fights break out over how many microns of particulate in a single square centimeter. And it's just, wow. So I think we do it to ourselves to a certain extent by setting a very high bar, particularly on a Fed ship or a Lursen or some of these pedigree yachts where there's a high expectation. So yeah, that's the reality. And of course, being in this industry as long as I have and being involved in literally hundreds of refits, that we could do podcasts after podcasts about that and some of the stories that can be told and some of the heartbreaks and amazing successes. It's both sides of the coin.
Yeah, no, I get that completely.
But you have had a lot of fun with Charade, and I understand that at one point in time, she was known as Valor.
Yeah, that's a funny story. So one of my good friends, who is the creator and producer of Below Deck, which has become a worldwide phenomenon reality show in the yacht world.
Yeah.
So, and put the concept together, and then phoned and said, Bobby, I want to use Charade for the TV show. And I said, you know what? It's not happening.
It's my baby.
Yeah, just got the boat. It's been refitted. It's like brand new. I'm not giving it to you. So he said, okay, no problem. Then a month or two goes by and he phones again and he said, look, Bobby, nobody will give me their boat to do this show. You have to help. I said, look, I just don't want to be associated with what happens. He goes, look, you're skiing March and April. Why don't you give me the boat March and April, and we'll change the name of the boat so nobody knows? And I thought, you know what? How much money are you going to give me? So he gave me enough. I couldn't say no to. And I said, okay, as long as you don't use Charade, the name, you can have the boat for 6 weeks. And it turned out to be a really profitable relationship for the two of us. So Charade became Valor. Or Valor.
Yep. Valor, okay.
Three different seasons. And actually four altogether. And it worked out well. I have no complaints.
Fantastic. Because that's been interesting. I managed one of the boats a year and a half ago. It was a 50 meter Hasten that was in that show. And I do recall when that ended, we brought the boat back up to Rybovich, I believe, for some refit work and repair work. The owner was a little unhappy with the condition that the boat was returned in, and that became a real conversation, particularly from the yacht management's perspective, trying to bring the boat back into order for the client, and the client wanting to use the boat and being told we got some work to do before really, and that was interesting. But obviously, the flip side is the boat's out there. It's in a really cool show produced by Bravo, and it's certainly in our industry. It's a lightning rod, the whole Below Deck thing.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm curious. Your boat carries, what, 12 crew, 11 crew, something like that, maybe?
It carries between 11 and 12.
So how did that work? Did your crew come off and they put their own crew on, or did you share a little bit of the resources there, or what's that look like?
In a nutshell, they arrive with eight crew, and three or four of my crew would stay on the boat to ensure that the boat is being looked after, nothing goes wrong,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera. So they're never on camera, but the crew that they bring on, obviously, you give a lot of young crew alcohol and put bows together, and then you've got drama.
You've got drama and the high seas. Because it's interesting working in those spaces and the placing crew, which I've been involved in, and working with owners with their crew, which is always a conversation. And it's part of the conversation I wanted to have with you. In the years I've been in this industry, I've talked to so many owners who have come to me and say, Rick, I love this yachting. I love my boat. It'd be perfect if I didn't have the crew on board. I've had other owners who come and said, I love my crew. I love the relationship I've got with them, their family. And then when something happens, it's heartbreaking. And they almost take it personally that a crew left or something adversely happened on board the boat they didn't see coming. And so crew is, I talk to people in the context that there are really three pillars. I call them the sacred triad that keeps our industry a healthy industry. And this is something that will repeat in my podcast again and again. Owners is the first leg. Without the owners in this industry, there's no industry. Crew is the second leg. You can't take the crew out and have an industry. And then I throw in the builders as the third leg, as you know, builders, ship reset yards, the entities that keep the ships being built and in service. But the crew piece of it, I think, is probably the more challenging because it's human factors and it's because it's culture. And you've got the owner's culture, and then you've got the evolving crew culture. And of course, the captain has a lot to say about what that crew culture could or should look like on board. So from the perspective that you bring, and this is why I wanted an owner to help me kick off this podcast, you bring a perspective that's unique because it's you. This is your boat. This is your investment, your asset. And to a certain extent, your captain and crew are also your asset. And how does that work for you? What's your view on that? And help us out here. Understand your perspective.
Everybody has their own style of managing their businesses, managing their whatever operations that they have going. You've got a boat like mine, right? You've got 11 or 12 different personalities living together 24/7 in a relatively small space, being the cruise quarters.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think by nature, I'm lucky enough that I am a people person. So I really try to involve our crew in with our guests. If we're heading to Norman's Key, we're going to dive the plane crash that happened there, Escobar's plane 100 years ago. And I want the crew to experience that as well. We're here. Let's get it off everybody's bucket list, including the crew. And doing that, it just makes everybody a little bit more relaxed. I still want a professionalism mentality, but I do want everybody to have fun, be relaxed, but ensure that the service is there.
There you go. Excellent. So it starts from the top, in your opinion, the captain, he sets the tone?
In every business, in every situation, it always starts from the top and it works its way down. And I'd be lucky to have some good captains, and it's been difficult, but overall has been a good experience.
Good. So I have to ask, as an industry, what could we do better? What, from your perspective, you're a successful businessman, an entrepreneur. You've seen the rise and fall of other businesses and I'm sure other industries. What does the luxury yachting industry bring today? And in your opinion, what could we do better?
I think every industry is having, trying to think of the right adjective, a rebalance, for lack of a better word, or a disruption. You look at, so we used to have phone books, and now you have Google. You used to have taxi cabs, now you have Uber. Yacht industry, and thinking, what is going to be the disruption in the yacht industry to really change it? I think a lot like the real estate market, to be paying a broker 10-15% to sell your boat. You're talking a $20 million boat, but it's $2 million you're giving somebody because he happens to be lucky enough to find somebody that buys your boat and it changes their life forever. So I do think, and I think it's already happening, some different companies that are trying to disrupt the sales method within the super yacht industry, because it makes no sense. I do wish there was a better way, and maybe I just don't know about it. There could be, but I think there's got to be a better way to manage the boats. You've got how many different flags that you can put on your boat, and each flag does something different depending on what country you're in, and your VAT tax in Europe, and commissions. And I mean, it's just rare.
Yeah.
And never ends.
No, exactly. And it's funny you mentioned that management piece, because there's a gentleman, Captain Herb Magny, who is a dear friend of mine. He's been in the industry as long as I have. And he and I are putting together a program right now for that very purpose. We've seen it ourselves, how the management of these vessels could so greatly improve. And in doing so, you improve the owner's experience. And in doing so, you improve the crew's experience. And that it ties into that whole sacred triad thing that I mentioned. Interesting to hear you say that, Bobby, because it's something that we're paying attention to as well. That's some nice validation. The reality check, you and I are close to the same age. I believe you're Canadian. I know nobody knows this. I was actually born in West Virginia, but I grew up in South Florida. And when I got into this industry in 1986, and I recently did this research because I did an interview with Triton Magazine and they kicked up back Dakwa. And the question came up. So when I got into this business back in the late middle 80s, there were 42 shipyards in North America. Canada had amazing industry out in the Pacific Northwest. And I had plugged into that. At the time, I had just started Nautical Structures, and there was just one other competitor really doing what we were doing. That was Mark Whipped over here in Pompano Beach. And so we were selling equipment to 42 shipyards that were building crew-served yachts, 80 feet and larger. It was an amazing time to be in the luxury yachting industry. And it wasn't an industry. It was a cottage. It was a cottage industry. It was a lot of entrepreneurial people and fish boat people building pretty white boats for some of their fishing clients and things like that. But it was real. It was growing. It was vibrant. And fast forward to right now, and I think you can count the remaining shipyards that are building these boats in North America on one hand. You might even have a finger left over. Tragic in so many ways. And so one of the goals I have in this podcast, talking to you and other people who have been around long enough to understand our history, is to talk about that in from the perspective, again, of getting into owning a boat. What would it take to get the confidence back to the consumer to where U.S. shipyards could regain their status as a world player in building yachts of size?
Right. It just all comes down to economics. I mean, you look at all the new shipyards that are opening up in China. You look at the shipyards that are in Turkey. The cost of labor is so much cheaper. All with Sunreef, they're building in Poland, and now they're building a new, or they just finished their new facility in Saudi Arabia, Dubai. Just think that we priced ourselves out of the market, and I don't see it coming back like a lot of industries we've had. But it just keeps coming back to economics. And if you have it built cheaper somewhere else, people are going to do it.
So if you look at that model and you look at the Northern European shipyards, they're existing on reputation and high standard depth.
Look, Fanship is Fanship. We're saying 100%. But as you said, there's only four or five brand names of that caliber, and that's where they are.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's true.
You may or may not know, but Fanship has just opened a new facility in Savannah, Georgia. So they are, they're getting that up and going. So it saves a lot of Fanship owners a lot of time instead of having to send our boats back to Holland to be refitted or painted or redone. It's nice to have a that shipyard here in the United States now where we can go.
Absolutely. And it's interesting you mention that, because I've worked with other Fed ship owners, and I've been involved in some reship programs where we've tried to get some of these boats refit here or up at Savannah Yachting Center. And Fed ship did a wonderful job of attracting these clients to ship their boats back to Amsterdam and use the facility they built there or up in Mockum to do this work. And it has been on the radar, and we've noticed the effort they've put into getting the Savannah program up and running. I know Ackerbloom was involved pretty strongly with some of that as well. So I think that's a net positive for the U.S. yachting industry. I think it's good that we can keep these boats over here and do that standard and work in a local shipyard. Yeah. And we got to give credit where credit's due there between Ted McCumber and the folks over at DeVries. I think they had a big push in that. Another quick question for you before we segue to the very last part of this. In your work with, did you do much work with the DeVoot Naval Architects?
No, not really. Again, my wife, Mrs. No Budget. We did have some conversations because apparently having just recently met her when I bought the boat, was not aware that she didn't like showers. She had to have a bath.
Ah.
The Fed ship had a his and hers shower, sink, toilet. So she thought it would be a great idea to start taking out some walls and moving walls forward. Realizing that on a yacht, you've got to go back to the marine engineers and Lloyd's of London and everybody sign off. And I've got to have the only $1 million bathtub on a boat. I finished. That's pretty well what it came in at.
You can't make this up, can you?
You know what? Right? Relationships can be difficult. Yeah. It went on the new girlfriend, but gosh.
Hey, Bobby, you took one for the team. So, last thing here before we wrap things up. You've got BG Signature. You've got a lifestyle business that is going. The smell test, from my perspective, is that had a lot to do with your family and your love of equestrian activities, polo. I don't know if many people know that you're a very accomplished polo player and an aficionado of the equestrian lifestyle. Seems to be congruent with yachting and other luxury brands. Want to tell me a little bit about BG Signature and how that segues into your family life?
Rick, it got to a point where, I've been incredibly blessed in the businesses that I've been involved in. And one tends to acquire antique wooden boats, yacht, homes, horses. And you get to a point where you look back and you think, okay, this is getting a little ridiculous. How do we start monetizing these things? How do we share them with friends and family and potential clients and monetize them? And it was really looking at the Richard Branson model of Yacht and creating this incredible experience. And having met Richard and Richard becoming a friend, that pushed me into creating a BG Signature experiences with the different homes that I have around the world and the boats and the plane and everything else that it encumbers. And Right. It's turned out well. In fact, it's turned out very well.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I love it. I love it. Again, as we share some things in common, and that is the love of the ocean, love of the family. I've got three boys. I think you've got two children, boy and girl.
Boy.
You have a little passion for diving like I do, I think.
I do until I go down and I see things that I've never seen before and then I get a little timid. But yeah.
That's why we do it though, right? Get down there and see something that's so unique.
Swim by where I'm just thinking, where the hell did you come
from? Right out of your peripheral vision.
Yeah,
they're always there.
And I may get up. I got to tell you.
I love it.
Speaking with you, and I hope we do it again. Time soon.
I hope so too. I'll be looking forward to the next opportunity to cross paths. I want to thank you, Bobby, for a great conversation and joining Yachting International's Yachta USA podcast. This is Rick Thomas with Bobby Genovese, and we are out of here.